morning, and welcome to Just One Thing, Simple Practices for Resilient Happiness by Dr. Rick Hansen. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix, from the Sun Sound Studios in Flagstaff. Rick Hansen, PhD, is a psychologist and New York Times best-selling author. He's been invited to speak at NASA, Oxford, Stanford, Harvard, and meditation centers worldwide. His books are available in 28 languages and include Making Great Relationships, Hardwiring Happiness, Just One Thing, and Mother Nurture. His work has been featured on the BBC, CBS, NPR, and other major media. And now, Just One Thing. What are you bracing against? The practice? Relax. You're going to be criticized. Why? The title of this practice is a little tongue-in-cheek. What I mean is, most of us, me included, spend time worrying about criticism, past, present, and even future. Yes, try hard, keep agreements, don't be evil, etc. But sooner or later, usually sooner, someone is going to point out the error in your ways. Often in subtle versions that still have an implicit criticism, such as giving advice, helping or teaching when you don't really need it, making corrections, comparing you negatively to others, or focusing on the one tile in the mosaic of your actions that's problematic, while staying mum about the 99 other good tiles. In other words, criticism is unavoidable. Sometimes we take it in with good grace, other times it stings, and sometimes both are true. As profoundly social human animals, it's natural for criticism to sting sometimes. But whatever sting is inherent, we add to this pain with the jabs that we give ourselves. This bonus pain, a self-inflicted wound, includes continuing the criticism inside your head long after the other person has moved on, or pounding on yourself way out of proportion to what happened. On a highly technical 1 to 10 messing up silly scale, MUSS, what you did was a 2, but on the related 0 to 10 fiercely undoing self-worth scale, FUSS, you are lambasting yourself at a 5 or even 10. Not fair at all. Or ignoring all your many other good qualities, the other 99 tiles, while ruminating about the criticism. We also jab ourselves with needless pain when we brace ourselves against possible future criticism or play needlessly small to avoid it. In many cases, the criticism is never going to happen, or it's very unlikely, or even if it did happen, it would not be a big deal. We tend to transfer into adult expectations we acquired as children or as younger adults. Maybe there was a lot of criticism from someone back then, but you're probably in a different place today. I've spent way too much of my life hunkering down or over-preparing to preempt an anticipated shaming attack that would actually not occur anyway. And even if the criticism does come, will it actually be the terrible experience you dread? Usually not. You can roll with it, take what's useful, form your own conclusions about the person making the criticism, learn, and move on. Accepting criticism as inevitable and refusing to live under its shadow will free you up and make you happier. How? When criticism, even subtle, comes your way, pause and try to sort it out in your own mind so you're sure you understand it. Sometimes criticism is narrow and specific, but often it's vague, general, and has multiple things mixed up in it. For example, some statements are accurate, but others are exaggerated. Tone, content, rationale, values. Slow down the interaction so it doesn't go off the rails. The ancient emotion centers in the brain get about a 2-second head start over the more recent logical centers. So buy yourself some time for all the resources inside your head to come online. Meanwhile, shore yourself up by thinking about people who like or love you, and by remembering some of the many ways you do good and are good. Once you understand the criticism in its parts and aspects, make your own unilateral decision about it. A fair amount of criticism that comes your way is flat out mistaken. The other person is wrong on the facts or doesn't understand the larger context. Think of the many scientific theories that were initially scorned but have proven correct over time. Of the criticism that remains, some is preferences or values disguised as thoughtful suggestions. For example, when you're driving, suppose the passenger says you should slow down or speed up when you actually are perfectly safe and the other person just likes it slower or faster. Some people value closeness more than others. Just because you like more cave time than your partner doesn't make you cold or rejecting. Nor is your partner smothering or controlling. It's just a difference in values. Grounds for inquiry, compassion, and negotiation, but not criticism. Another chunk of criticism coming at you is thoughtful suggestions disguised as moral fault finding. Now your passenger says you should be ashamed of yourself for endangering others when in fact all you need to do is back off another couple of car lengths from the car in front of you on the freeway. You're not reckless, but could be more skillful. Then there is that which is worthy of healthy remorse. It's up to you to decide what this part is. Feel what's appropriate, learn the lesson, make amends if they're called for, know that you've done what you could, ask yourself how much remorse or shame you'd want a friend to bear who did whatever you did, and then see if you can ask no more or less from yourself. Knowing that you can handle criticism in these ways, let yourself be more open to it. Don't stonewall or intimidate others who have a criticism for you. Then it just festers or bursts out in other ways. But also, don't walk on eggshells to avoid trouble, unless you're in a dangerous situation, which is a different sort of problem, or obsess or overplan to make sure you make no mistakes. A close friend is an extremely successful professor at the top of the food chain elite university, and I asked him once what led to his success. He said that while his colleagues and competitors were perfecting their one paper, he was finishing three of his own. One of these would be rejected for publication, one would come back with corrections he could make, and one would be accepted immediately. Then, when the inevitable criticisms did come down the road, he'd already moved on to his next three papers. Mostly, just recognize that criticism in its various forms and flavors and smells is a fact of life. So be it. Our lives and this world have bigger problems and much bigger opportunities. Time to live more bravely and freely. You are listening to Just One Thing, Simple Practices for Resilient Happiness by Dr. Rick Hansen, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. And here's another. Know where you stand. To know where you stand, we need to know the facts. Is the stove turned off? Do I have health insurance? Does my partner love me? Are the people who work for me getting the job done? We also need to know our values. What is fair, decent, good, and proper? This is knowing where you stand. It's necessary for safety, well-being, and success. Being foggy about the facts and unclear about values is like driving a car eyes closed and not caring what happens. In a piece that's longer than usual and draws on a previous essay, I'm focusing here on knowing the facts of U.S. politics and policy, because these have become personally relevant and often upsetting for so many people. If you consider this an improper subject for me, there's no need to listen any further. Valuing the truth. America had an election on November the 8th, 2016, but on every day, this country and all others face a more fundamental question. Facts. Yes or no? Democracy is impossible without a basic consensus about what's true. The common good requires common ground. Unfortunately, the truth is that many of us don't know what the truth is. Fact-based journalism has been replaced by horse race commentary and false equivalents. Fake news spreads virally through social media. People refuse to recognize facts that contradict their beliefs or challenge group loyalty. Businesses, politicians, and nations suppress facts, hide them in clouds of disinformation, and attack scientists and journalists, as well as ordinary people who point out that the emperor is wearing no clothes. Yet it's surprisingly easy to find a credible answer to most questions. Just do a quick search of Wikipedia, a major newspaper, the BBC, university websites, or online journalists with similar sources. Plus, the big picture is usually already obvious. In a Bob Dylan line, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Then we need to relate the facts to our values. So I should disclose some of my own. I'm for civil liberties, against cheaters and tyrants, and was a registered libertarian for many years. I'm deeply grateful to those who have served our country. I'm for children human rights, and the earth altogether. Social primate politics. Politics at all levels, from grade school playgrounds to the UN, is grounded in the social structure of primate and human hunter-gatherer bands, in which alphas try to gain power to control resources such as food and reproduction. With the development of agriculture about 10,000 years ago, wealth and power became even more concentrated in the hands of a few, enabling them to support warriors to enforce their rule and priests to justify it. I'm not saying that all those who have wealth and power gained it unfairly, but throughout history, wealth and power have been used routinely to confuse and frighten the many for the benefit of the few, and to rig the system to gain even more wealth and power. The classic strategy is to repeat the big lie, hide facts, whip up fears about them attacking us, and exploit our vulnerability as tribal beings to grievance, anger, and payback. America since 1960. Does this sound familiar? It's happened a lot over the last 40 years in America and is now at a fever pitch. Here's a summary of relevant facts and skim whatever you already know. The 1960s swing toward civil rights, environmentalism, feminism, gay rights, a strong safety, social safety net, and support for blue-collar workers, forming the base for the Democratic Party. The Republican Party responds with its Southern strategy to win over white voters and becomes a coalition of wealthy people, traditionalists, and fundamentalists serving each other's interests. By Republican or Democrat, I mean the leadership and policy core of each party, not people in general who vote for one party or another. Republican policy favors low regulation of business, low taxes on the wealthy, and a minimal social safety net, while Democratic policy is the opposite. Then and now, large majorities prefer Democratic policies. Therefore, the Republican Party recognizes it must do five things to win elections. Suppress voting, for example, gerrymandering. Obscure facts, for example, block research into global warming. Create mistrust of the government, for example, they're coming to take your guns. Heighten fears and appeal to patriotism, religion, and ethnic identity. In 1968, Richard Nixon promises law and order. He, Spiro Agnew, and top aides break multiple laws and leave office for prison or disgrace. Starting in 1980, Ronald Reagan and his Congress slash taxes on the wealthy, deregulate the finance industry, and attack unions, workplace safety, and other protections for working class people, running as a moralist standing up to liberal decadence. Reagan's terms contain much corruption and illegal activity, including Iran-Contra and the savings and loan scandal. A network of Republican think tanks, wealthy donors, talk radio programs, and media outlets, for example, Fox, Drudge, and Breitbart, develops. It attacks the government as takers who rob makers, while in fact the rural counties and states that comprise the Republican base are high net takers of government services paid for by urban, mainly Democratic taxpayers. Bill Clinton becomes president in 1992. Taxes are raised on the wealthy, the economy grows strongly, and the national debt begins shrinking. Running as traditionalists and moralists, Newt Gingrich and his party attack longstanding traditions and norms of government. They shut down the federal government, weaponize probes into Bill and Hillary Clinton, and impeach Bill to delegitimize his presidency. Gingrich is revealed to be a serial adulterer, and his successor, Dennis Hassert, is a child molester. Many years of legal investigations of both Clintons prove that Bill lied about consensual sex with an intern. At the end of his second term, there's a projected federal surplus of $5 trillion over the next 10 years. Al Gore gets a 500,000 votes, more votes than George W. Bush, but the result in Florida is critical for the Electoral College. There's widespread suppression of Democratic votes in the state. Republican election officials halt a recount enforced 5-4 by Republican justices on the Supreme Court, and Bush becomes president. After running as a compassionate conservative, Bush swings to the right and cuts controls over the financial sector, taxes on the wealthy, and help for the working class. Wealth inequality and the middle class incomes stay flat. The denial of facts accelerates. Bush downplays repeated warnings about Al-Qaeda, and on September the 11th, 2001, over 3,000 Americans die. In 2003, U.S. forces invade Iraq based on White House exaggerations of ambiguous intelligence regarding ties to Al-Qaeda and weapons of mass destruction, neither of which are found. The cost of this invasion and the occupation that followed will be about 190,000 lives and $2.2 trillion. Released from regulation, the financial sector implodes, triggering the Great Recession, throwing millions of people out of work. The $5 trillion surplus disappears, replaced by a doubling of the national debt for a six-fold increase under the Republican presidents. Republican officials suppress voting through eliminating polling sites, reducing voting hours and days, intimidation, and voter ID laws. They also gerrymander congressional districts to tilt the electoral playing field further, and in 2012, Democrats received 1.4 million more votes for the House of Representatives, yet Republicans won control of the House by a 234-201 margin. In most red states, the only serious challenge to a Republican politician comes from the right. Consequently, Republican policies have become much more conservative since Ronald Reagan, while Democratic policies have remained roughly the same. Legal authority or moral legitimacy. Wow, I haven't even included every possible detail, but the essence above is factually accurate. At this point, I'm going to speak more of my own values. The United States has only one national election for president, and Democrats have won the popular vote 4 out of the last 5 times. Yet through the actions of the Republican-allied Supreme Court in 2000 and the FBI in 2016, 2 out of 4, 50% of those popular votes have been effectively nullified to appoint a Republican president. Most recently, a foreign power shook the foundation of our republic, the electoral process. How do you think the Wall Street Journal, Paul Ryan, the Koch brothers, Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, and the National Rifle Association would react if these facts were reversed. Besides common ground, the common good requires common values. Rights for us must be rights for them, and rules for them must be rules for us. We respect fair competition on a level playing field, even if we don't like the results. But if one team has to cheat to win, that's a team that deserves to lose. It's human nature to accuse others of the darkness we hope to hide in ourselves. For decades, Trump and others like him have accused their opponents of being illegitimate. But actually, it is Trump and his allies who have acquired power through rigging the system, and it is Democrats who have championed voting rights, whose policies are preferred by most Americans, and whose candidates have won most recent national elections. Knowing these facts and knowing your values, no one can take that away from you. You may not be able to change injustice, but it is calming and strengthening to know where you stand about it. Then stand up. I am trying to stand up myself here. Then we can stand together now and in the years ahead, standing for what is true and what we value, for our own sake and that of all others. You have been listening to Just One Thing, Simple Practices for Resilient Happiness by Dr. Rick Hansen, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix, thanking you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day. And now, stay tuned for more interesting programming coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona.